This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Friday, April the 12th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We've got something a little bit different for you today. We were out on the road. We were in Belfast this week discussing a range of political issues north and south of the border with our learned panel in front of a live audience in the Mac in Belfast. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, and you are very welcome to the Mac in Belfast for the Inside Politics podcast live event from the Irish Times. It gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today, my fellow Irish Times journalists, Freya McClements, our Northern editor, and Pat Leahy, our political editor, and our special guests, Lisa Clare Whitten from Queen's University, and Alex Kane, who is a regular columnist for the Irish Times as well as for other newspapers too. It's great to have you here. Freya, when we planned this event a few weeks ago, we thought we'd just be talking about the year of elections and how that applies north of the border and south of the border and some of the other issues which have come up. But then everything bloody changed. And we're not going to talk about Simon Harris because, Pat, I'm already bored with Simon Harris.
As your editorial this morning made clear.
The editorial was anonymous. Let's talk instead about that moment only 2 weeks or so ago, Freya, when everything got turned upside down in Northern Irish politics. And maybe you could just tell us from your perspective how that played out over those 24 hours or so.
Yeah, because funny, just when we were talking a little earlier and I said to you, well, you know, isn't it awful we've just decided to do this podcast at a time when absolutely nothing has been happening in politics?
That.
You know, how on earth are we going to find something to talk about? But I think, to step back very briefly, even a little bit further, we're just at the beginning of April. At the beginning of this year, there was no devolved government in Northern Ireland. There was no assembly. There was no executive. All of that was hanging in the balance. So we've just had everything around the restoration of Stormont. You know, we now have a first and deputy first minister again. And I was literally actually the night before all this broke, we were sort of sitting back over dinner and I was saying, well, you know, hopefully that's us for a while. You know, it's sort of all this kind of mad politics stuff is over. You know, we have a nice kind of, you know, straightforward ease ourselves into the summer. You know, we'll worry about the election in the autumn. It's all going to be fine. And there's always that thing, isn't it, about events that overtake you. And I think there was a little bit of an inkling the night before, and Gillie Beattie, Belfast Live, and the Mirror had published a court case around two unnamed individuals, and I think that the message she'd put on Twitter is that this is going to be big. And I'm going to hold my hands up because I was actually in bed on the Friday morning, on Good Friday morning. I was off.
Where else did you?
I was on a day off, you know, so it wasn't that I'd kind of
Half 11.
And it was no. It may only have come onto your radar at half 11. It was on our radar at about 7 a.m. and my phone just started going mad, and I sort of went, you know, I'm not on today. Somebody else is on today. And a friend phoned me and said, you really need to be on this today. And there was this kind of moment when we sort of knew what was happening.
And was that coming through back channels from within the DUP, or was that whole business of his social media and website?
This was coming through sources,
okay.
I think is the phrase that one would use in this circumstance. But I mean, it was also being played out in very real time in social media, and there are huge pitfalls around that. You know, when you're there as a journalist and you're reporting on this, you're looking to report fact, and you're also looking to report what you can say legally, as opposed to this wild west of social media. And you know, there are very important and very real reasons around that. Not just when dealing with a case of this type, the victims in a case like this, or the alleged victims, are entitled to lifelong anonymity, and that's sacrosanct. So you have to be really, really careful on a whole load of levels. But I knew, and it was pretty apparent by mid-morning that there was a meeting of the DUP going on. Presumably like everybody else, actually just trying to get their heads around, first of all, what was happening. And I knew we were going to have to write a news story about this when something happened. You know, the DUP was going to have to say something, and then we'd have to write a news story about this. But also I was going to have to write an analysis piece. And I remember actually one of the people that I tried to phone actually was Alex.
Because I was in bed.
You were also in bed.
What is it with you people?
You know, the hardworking, you know, northern journalists. But you're actually just trying to get your head around this because it's such a completely unforeseen circumstance, and you're trying to kind of game out in your head, well, what are the consequences here? And there were so many potential consequences because you're thinking about, okay, Geoffrey Donaldson at the Lagan Valley seat, the next election, that the DUP, you know, look at where the DUP has just come from. What does this mean for the party? What does this mean, above all, for the institutions, for the Stormont institutions? And I was on the phone all morning, and I was on the phone to somebody else, not Alex, when a statement then dropped in from the DUP at 1 minute to one. And Talk Back, well, it was going to the news at one, and then Talk Back was on air. And how, I'm sure a lot of you heard it, but the shock in people's voice, and you could literally hear people, I mean, seasoned, you know, political correspondents for decades, people like Gareth Gordon, the BBC, Suzanne Breen, Belfast Tiger, you could just see them actually trying to get their heads around it in real time. And I think there was at least a day, 2 days, when anybody you talked to was just sort of saying, oh my God, you know, it kind of came so much out of left field. And then as a journalist, you're trying to get your head around that. And I don't know, just to give you kind of another look under the bonnet, I don't know how many people here read. So I wrote the analysis piece. I'd spent all morning trying to figure out, what am I going to say? What's the consequences here? I had to make a call that it wasn't going to bring down the institutions, that they were probably were safe. And then the news editor phoned and said, can you have that by 2 o'clock? And I said, it's 1:30. And he says, yeah, I know. I said, this is, yeah, I've got half an hour to write this sort of considered analysis. So I said, right, so I better get off the phone then. And actually, sometimes the pieces, I mean, I don't know, you can tell me later on whether you think it worked, but sometimes...
I thought it worked.
Well, thank you. Hugh has to say this. But actually, sometimes the pieces that you write just in the moment of it, kind of reacting to it, sometimes are better than the ones that you spend all day agonising over.
Maybe particularly in these moments of kind of heightened everything, maybe that is the best way to...
Because, you know, you're just trying to get your head round what are the consequences, and the consequences were potentially so huge. I mean, you know, the rest of the panel will have a view on this, but one of the things that was going through my mind was, you know, what if Geoffrey Donaldson had been Deputy First Minister, which he might have been? You know, I think had that been the circumstance, you would have been very quickly into a major crisis for the institutions, because these political institutions here in Northern Ireland are not strong. You know, we'd no government from 2017 to 2020, no government for the last 2 years. It's only just back up. Something like that, I think, would have been really in major crisis. Whereas as it was, the DUP was able to, in a sense, distance themselves from it and say, this is a party matter, we're dealing with it. Geoffrey Donaldson has been suspended from the party, and emphasised stability. And that became really clear as the day went on, that it was going to be, it was about stability within the DUP, but it was also about stability within the institutions. And that's what we've seen, really.
So let me ask Alex about that. What are the consequences? Obviously, we're not going anywhere near the case itself, but the circumstances are that one of the most significant figures in Northern Irish politics for the last generation or more has sort of disappeared like a puff of smoke in shocking circumstances, and he's gone. And listening to Freya talk there about the sort of the shock on the day, I'm sort of quite taken by the way, in the days and weeks since, everything's been slightly eerily quiet.
There's nothing worse in politics than eerily quiet, because it usually means there are all sorts of interplays going on and all sorts of people plotting or making up their own versions of stories. I think when I first heard, I got my first phone call at 4:15, on the Friday morning. And it was odd because that evening I'd been having dinner with my partner. We were just chatting and I was looking back over some stuff, because you always get, it was the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Somebody always wants some commentary. So I was looking up the 1998 stuff, and I'd written a note at the end of the main stuff and I'd said, saw Geoffrey on the sidelines trying to hog some headlines. And a few hours later... He had taken, so just so sometimes politics has a funny way of, you know, repeating itself. But the immediate thing, there's the personal thing, because this is someone I've known for 40 years, and it is very difficult in circumstances like that, you know, to get your head around. I mean, we first met, I'd say, it was probably the late 1970s, and we were in the Ulster Unionist Party together for years, worked very closely for years. So the first bit, and I know this sounds a sort of selfish thing, but the first bit was trying to separate my knowledge of this person, someone who I would describe as a friend, and suddenly have to put it aside. Because the first time in my life, because sometimes you have to write difficult things about people you know, but it's just a bit of criticism, and you might meet their wife in the street and say, you're a complete so-and-so, you know, he's doing his best. And you go, but, you know, this was much bigger than that, and you had to move on to the political side of it fairly quickly. And the first thing, of course, was, were the institutions in danger? And the key to the institutions being in danger or not in danger lay in the date that the allegations were levelled. Because if they were levelled before the deal was done, if they were levelled before, it was the 31st of January when the DUP had their meeting and finally signed it off, and Donaldson made a really hard push, took control, had his Trimble moment, his real, proper, bona fide Trimble moment, took possession of this deal and won over people who were saying to me a few days earlier that they were unpersuadable. If the allegations had landed and the police were aware of them before that deal was done, well, two things. The government would have been aware of it. The security forces, MI5, would have been aware of it. So that was the first thing. So within a few days, it became clear that this was post the agreement. So that steadied things. The other thing that might have shaken things, it's one of the great things in politics, it's the unexpected moment. Because when the deal was done and the Stormont was rebooted, it sort of embedded itself fairly. It wasn't doing anything exciting, which is all you can expect the Northern Ireland Assembly to do anyway. But there was a feeling that Donaldson's critics were backing off. They weren't going to challenge him. But suddenly this moment came when there was going to be a leadership contest. So those critics had their moment. If they wanted to even put this to a vote again, make their whole leadership challenge based on the vote, even the, you know, if it was, you know, a challenger and Gavin Robinson, for example, even if Gavin won, but won with only 52%, that would have destabilised the party. He would have had to get much tougher. It would have been a very difficult sell. The party would have spooked, particularly coming up to an election. But within 24 hours, it was clear that there was going to be no challenge.
So why is that? Why no challenge?
Nobody wanted to. Sammy Wilson, the only three possible ones. The Lords couldn't, whatever Lord Morrow and Lord Dodds may have thought, they weren't. The rules don't allow them to challenge for the leadership. So the only three possibilities were Sammy Wilson, and Sammy Wilson is the same age as I am, and really, you know, you don't want to be
45.
Yes, you really do not want to be taking over a political party in the middle of a crisis, an unprecedented crisis in Northern Ireland politics. So Sammy just said, oh no, Gavin's fine. Carlo Lockhart has no interest in being leader. And Ian Paisley, who I think for all these years hasn't realised that he's actually held in, you know, what's the word that I won't be sued over? He's not liked as much as he thinks he is. So it would have been nice to see him challenged for the leadership, just to see him humiliated. But, you know, and it would have given me a column that I've been longing to write for about 30 years. But that's neither here nor there. Within 48 hours or so, it became clear that the DUP, and I'll say something for them in this case, particularly Gavin, who is an immensely affable, likeable, calm person. You know, if you're going to have a crisis, have someone like Gavin there at the centre. And he managed to talk to people. He managed to settle people. He managed to be... And who would have thought, you know, on Friday when the story broke, and by Monday afternoon, 72 hours later, that a sort of serenity had come. They had created what I think Freya mentioned, the distance. Because the one thing they won't know, and you can never tell in politics when a story like this hits, particularly your leader, you don't know for certain whether your voting base, forget other voters, but whether your voting base will link the story between what the leader has done and the party itself. Mm. And I think that moment will only be known when the charges are read out in open court.
Is there another element, Lisa, which is, it seems to me, perhaps wrongly, is that apart from not having a candidate, so to speak, now might not quite be the moment. I mean, I'm sure there is discontent, ongoing discontent within the DUP, but I've seen some commentators suggest that those who are discontented may feel that now is not the moment, perhaps wait until after the Westminster elections.
I think the analogy I would make is when something happens in a family context and there's a crisis that's unexpected from left field, no one saw it coming, and that very human felt shock. I mean, that wasn't just isolated to the DUP on that Good Friday, as conversation has so far indicated. There was a general this was came from nowhere and is not a normal Northern Ireland politics sort of crisis or event. And so I think that something unexpected, family setting, the argument you were having the night before doesn't matter as much, just in that moment. And you do often get a sense of solidarity. Everybody mucks in, pulls together. We're all in this. And that paradoxically has, I think, created this sense of serenity and an eerie sort of stillness. And putting it in the broader context of the lead up before the this revelation, we were perhaps, there was a sense of a moment of like a fresh chapter for Northern Ireland with the restoration of the institutions, the long Brexit saga of that is definitely not over, but we were in the first moment of something bordering on consensus of all Northern Ireland voices and politicians to be, to a degree, willing to make the post-Brexit position that we're now in work, and the freshness of, you know, First and Deputy First Minister and a sense of something quasi-unity, that sort of newness.
Because there didn't seem to be huge anger out there, even, you know, on the, you know, on the anti-Northern Ireland Protocol side even. No. Like, there was no, you know, anger on the streets or even party meetings, was there, in a significant way?
Not in a significant way at all.
So is Gavin Robinson then the best kind of, I mean, well, I hear him being described as here today, is he the right kind of leader for the moment, really? A reluctant leader, one gathers, as well.
I think he's a reluctant leader. Not an unwilling leader. Yeah. And he's been very clear to sort of, he's a party man, he'll do what needs done. But I think reluctant leader with an unenviable set of circumstances. And that sense of solidarity that we're sort of seeing within the party and the statements of support from those that it has been clear we're on a very different side, particularly on the safeguarding the union deal and internal protocol related DUP challenges. But they're all sort of on board at the moment. The question is, how long does that last?
So, Pat, we have two parties in Ireland. I think, right to say, the second largest party and the third largest party on the island of Ireland have changed their leaders in the last couple of weeks. And in one case, we have a reluctant leader who never wanted the job. And in the other case, we don't have that. And if we were to accept for a moment the picture painted by Michelle O'Neill and Mary Lou McDonald that we might have a successful vote on unity before the end of this decade, these are both young men. They could both lead the merger of the new FGDUP in the new jurisdiction and still only be in their mid-40s.
Well, that might happen. But I wouldn't bet on it. I'm not entirely sure what your question was, but if you would like me to talk, I will.
I know you will.
I mean, it seems to me, just to reflect on what the guys have said about the Donaldson situation, I suspect that the medium-term political effects of it are kind of in the freezer at the moment, but they will be taken out of the freezer at some stage. And a couple of the triggering events for that, I would imagine, would be how the eventual trial happens, what sort of restrictions are on that with regard to identification of victims and so forth. And without going into any speculation on that, you can see how that might have profound effects on the politics in how it is reported, how it is permitted to be reported. And let us not forget, because like everybody else, Geoffrey Donaldson is innocent until proven guilty, the eventual verdict in that trial. And I think that will have a big effect on the political effects of it here. The other thing I think that will kind of unfreeze those political effects is the elections, when the elections come, because I don't think it's the most profound piece of political analysis that you will hear tonight, but I suspect this isn't very good for the DUP. And how that plays out, who it benefits, I'm be interested to know what you guys think. It seems to me that to the extent that there is electoral fallout from it, the likely beneficiaries are more likely to be the UUP than than the TUV, but I'd be happy to hear what you guys have to say about that. But I think the fact that the DUP has steadied the ship, that the institutions haven't had a significant wobble since that, and, you know, looking at the story and trying to gauge reaction in Dublin, certainly, that morning when I was up and working on the story at about 7 o'clock that morning.
Half six, I thought. Yeah.
It was very clear that Dublin's,
Dublin gets up early in the morning.
Yeah. A nation of people get up early in the morning. But that Dublin's primary concern was, you know, even as the thing was unfolding, that this doesn't have any effect on the institutions. But all that, it seems to me, the steadiness, the relative steadiness of the DUP and the stability of the institutions, that is before the effects, the real political effects on the DUP actually come to pass.
So is Pat right for it? Do the Ulster Unionists stand to benefit most? Because I would have thought that the DUP's return to the executive would have shored up further leakage to the UUP, but maybe that's oversimplistic.
I think, and I mean, I'd be interested to hear what the others say on this as well, but I think you have to bear in mind in this context that we're talking about a Westminster election, and I think the effects, the damage to the DUP would have been greater had it not been a Westminster election. And to unpack that a bit, when it's at Westminster election, when you're voting for an MP, it's first past the post. You know, so it's you go in, you have a list of candidates, and you put an X against
it's
one
of them.
It's a
very rudimentary,
and that's it. Yeah,
and a Neanderthal form.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, you know, you may possibly say that. You know, we, you know, up here in the north, we're used to lots of different
you
type
have it
of election. We have it both. So, had it been, for example, an assembly election or a council election, where it is. The vote is spread out. You know, you go in and you vote 1, 2, 3, and your preferences are spread out. I think it would have had a much greater significance because, again, the reality of elections in Northern Ireland is that Westminster elections, it's going to come down to a handful of candidates. Sometimes there might be 2 or 3 candidates only on the ballot box. And the question facing unionist voters in the constituencies where unionists have a chance of winning a seat, and this argument will be put sometimes subtly, sometimes less subtly, but the argument that will be put forward is, well, the DUP will say, we are the only unionist candidate who can win a seat here. Do you want a unionist winning the seat, or do you want Alliance winning it? Do you want maybe the UUP winning it? But that will be the argument which is made. So bearing in mind all that's going on, I think that will lessen the potential electoral impact. Now, there's some constituencies we can get into. I think Lagan Valley, potentially Geoffrey Donaldson's seat. He was facing a big challenge there from Saoirse Eastwood of Alliance anyway. She will absolutely see her opportunity now. East Belfast, I'm sure we'll talk about. Gavin Robinson, the new DUP leader, this is his seat. He's on a majority of about 1,800 against Alliance. You know, the question there will be, if the TUV run a candidate, could that take sufficient votes away? So Gavin,
can I ask a question just seat? Listening to you there, because I'm nearly as old as Alex.
Sort of getting into the weeds of the
well, a little bit, and,
here,
and
but,
I'm old enough to remember the absolute sectarian headcount kind of situations that you had in these elections, not just on the unionist side, but on the nationalist side. Exactly the same arguments were made. You have to have one candidate because otherwise the other side will get it. Does that argument have as much potency when Alliance is the challenger as when it's the other side of the sectarian divide?
I think it still does because realistically, so to take a seat like East Belfast, Sinn Féin aren't going to win a seat in East Belfast. The SDLP aren't going to win a seat in East Belfast. So the challenger there is not a nationalist party. So some of the narrative that will be spun is that, well, Alliance are nationalist light. Well, they're really nationalists. If you don't vote for a unionist candidate, you're actually opening a door to, you know, yeah, nationalism light, as it were. So the argument becomes about, do you want a unionist to win, or do you want somebody who's not a unionist to win? So there isn't really, I mean, again, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there are actually any seats where the battle is between nationalism and unionism. North Belfast would have been in the last election.
It was probably previously going to be.
And there were packs there, but you would imagine that John Finucane will take that seat again. So usually you're talking about battles between unionism and Alliance, or in Foyle, which will be another big battle. It's between the SDLP and Sinn Féin. The one, and again, the others will come into this as well, the one exception to that, I think, is South Antrim, which I think is going to be really interesting because Robin Swan of the UUP has moved constituencies, and the sitting candidate there, the sitting MP, DUP's Paul Girvan, has a majority of about 3,000, I think. Robin Swan, hugely popular health minister, you know, the best known of the UUP candidates. I think he could have I think it was a really smart move on behalf of the UUP. Mm. He could have a chance there. We haven't talked about Stephen Farry in South Down as well, but, you know, by and large, these are the kind of contests we're talking about. But I think this has been a very, very long-winded answer to your original question. Fair play to anybody who can actually remember the original question. Just in terms of talking about the potential impact of all of this on this controversy on the DUP's electoral chances, I think because it's a Westminster election, it lessens that somewhat. And I think also, assuming we're talking about an autumn election, you know, there's a chance for the DUP to put a bit of clear water between what's happening now and the election. Now, Pat's absolutely right. The problem is if you have court appearances, if you have a trial, it's something that's going to keep this in the public eye. But I think, again, the case will be made, and not necessarily overtly, but it will certainly be in people's minds. You know, if you're sitting, for example, in East Belfast, it's, well, do you want the only unionist who can win the seat, or do you want Alliance? In Lagan Valley, it's, well, do you want a unionist, or do you want Alliance? And it's going to be really interesting to see. I think Gavin Robinson, I was about to say, I think he'll hold on depending on what happens about a TUV candidate. I think Lagan Valley may be harder.
Can I ask a question, which maybe to Alex maybe seem a bit odd, but how much do the Westminster elections matter? We know that they have mattered historically at times in the past, in the relatively recent past, when the DUP held great sway at Westminster because of the composition of the parties. But I think it's fairly safe to predict that there's going to be a Labour comfortable, if not enormous, majority next time out. So that issue is not going to be in play. So to what extent is this another symbolic contest about what is the nature of Northern Ireland now in 2024, rather than being about political power and gaining or losing of it?
I think the Westminster election does matter simply because it's the headcount. It's the headcount going to Westminster at the 2019 election. For the first time in its history, unionism returned a minority of MPs, which damages you. It sends a message to people who sit in Westminster, whether it's a Labour government, Conservatives. They take the message from that, you know, for all the stuff of the DUP propping up the government and so on, that they're not really terribly popular. They don't really have the support. And I think for the DUP, it's about unionism collectively wants to be able, even if it's only by one seat, they want to be able to say that unionism represents the majority of people in Northern Ireland. The problem with what we have now, as it stands right now, Freya was talking about the battle between unionism and nationalism and the battle between unionism and Alliance. The much bigger battle, in some senses, is the battle between unionist parties. Because right now, as it stands, all three unionist parties have said they will stand in every single seat. If they stand in every single seat, then I would make a bet with anybody, in fact, I will at some point anyway, that against that background, unionism would come back with probably 5 seats, because they would tear each other. Now, we had Jim Allister, I think, the story in today's newspapers about he had proposed some sort of new pact with unionism, which
You don't buy that.
Well, I always would think of them, you know, if you're going to call it a pact, call it, you know, the Federation of United Kingdom Unionist Parties, which is worked out at FUKUP, which is in essence, because they get a pact and they immediately start fighting each other. They will fight on any issue. And that's the problem. I mean, as a lifelong unionist, as someone who has no difficulty with my unionism, who is comfortable with my unionism, I don't really care what a person's sexual orientation or gender or political background or professional background. I don't give a damn how they lead their lives. If they can be persuaded to vote to stay in the United Kingdom, I will encourage unionist parties to find ways. But when you advise, as I've done for the past 50 years, to you that the best way of maybe making people comfortable and not wanting to rock the boat is to make them feel that they are the same in terms of equality of citizenship as unionism are. But when unionism, even now, 50 years after my first article I wrote about the challenges facing unionism, I could change a couple of names and send the same column to you, and I will tomorrow. And you, so, but that's the thing about unionism, that the battle right now is what unionism wants to be, what it wants Northern Ireland to be, what it means to be a unionist in Northern Ireland, and how somehow we got, there is, unionism cannot be one party, because to say it's one party is to say that all unionists are the same. They're not. You can't have one traditional party and one sort of liberal party.
Although again, you did have a monolithic unionism for a very long time.
We didn't actually. We had a pretend monolithic unionism, but it was still fighting each other. And the minute the bubbles went, the minute the power went, the minute that a government could no longer buy them off with things and say, look, there's a factory or there's this or there's that. The moment that power went, people say what happened to unionism wasn't some great ideological collapse. It was the collapse of Stormont. Because suddenly there was no one to keep them happy. You could no longer buy them off. And at that moment, if you look at the period from 1972 to 1985, something like 27 varieties of unionism put themselves forward for election, each and every single one of whom said they were the true, pure form of unionists. And even now, right now, we have three unionist parties. And you say maybe there's a chance for the Ulster Unionist Party, Freya. I've worked for the Ulster Unionist, been an Ulster Unionist for most of my life. My dad was a very senior member of it. You know, the party is still a party which is not led from the top, it's led from the grassroots. I remember Alistair Campbell telling me once, having had to deal with each of the parties trooping into 10 Downing Street, and so you'd see all the parties going, the leader would say something, he'd have his delegation, they'd all nod, yes, that's fine. Every time it was the Ulster Unionist, and they'd say, David, are you okay? David would look around his delegation, and somebody would go, I'm not really happy with that leader. My people on the ground won't be happy with that. And that's the problem. David would defer to them. Gavin Robinson is going to defer to people. Jim Alistair doesn't defer to anyone, even members of his own, doesn't defer to anyone at all. And just as a matter of interest, when people say that Jim Alistair wants to have more people in the Assembly, he doesn't want anybody else in the Assembly. He's serious. He just wants to be in there by himself, because the minute you give him company, he has no bloody point in politics.
You're listening to the Inside Politics podcast live from Belfast. Stay with us. We're going to be back with more from Alex Kane, Lisa Whitten, Freya McClements, Pat Leahy and myself after this short break.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Pat, you're from Tipperary, and people down there don't really think about Northern Ireland very much, I know, very far south.
We don't think of anybody north of Limerick, really.
No, that's true, but we've been talking about unionism, but from the nationalist perspective, there's clearly this division as well. I mean, one of the blocks that stands in the way of reforming the Belfast Agreement in a kind of significant way that we might be talking about is both of the largest parties in Northern Ireland. And Sinn Féin's political agenda doesn't really seem to include making Northern Ireland a better place. It includes getting rid of Northern Ireland.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that is interesting about how Michelle O'Neill has comported herself and spoken since she became First Minister is, and I think this was reflected in the election campaigns as well, that they did speak about, Sinn Féin did speak about making Northern Ireland work and, making life better for people in Northern Ireland, improving public services, bread and butter issues like health service and various other public services. I think Sinn Féin has talked a lot about those. It's always been, I suppose, the kind of question hovering about Sinn Féin's operation of the institutions as to whether it really wanted to make Northern Ireland a success, given that its most important long-term aim is the abolition of Northern Ireland. So I think that's a complicating factor. But going back to what we were talking about with unionism earlier, if there is that sort of ambiguity on the nationalist side, then it seems to me that there's doubly so on the unionist side, because unionism's sense of its political future doesn't seem to me to have moved on to accommodate the non bifurcated nation that is here, or the non-bifurcated polity that is here at the moment. I mean, as you'll know, we've done loads of research over the last couple of years about the, you know, the preferences, political preferences of the Neithers, and they're one of the really fascinating things that are happening in Northern Ireland at the moment. Not just the growth of, you know, of the Neithers, but also the fraying of the ties between, you know, religious background and political choice, and the growing emergence of a sense of politics in Northern Ireland that doesn't necessarily wish to see every single political issue refracted through the lens of the constitutional question. And I think that's one of the interesting things that is going on there. So just as, you know, there is this ambiguity, I suppose, or slight confusion of aims on the nationalist side, there is also a lot of questions about the post-agreement political future of unionism and how it sees itself. And I think that is something that in the imaginable future, in the foreseeable future, as the constitutional question becomes a permanent part of politics, both north and south, I think that unionism, that is something that unionism is going to have to catch up with. And it always struck me during that long period where the DUP was refusing to revive the institutions, it always struck me as a self-defeating strategy for unionism. Because if there is to be an even medium-term future for the union, that must involve convincing the Neithers, or and the people in the middle, convincing them that Northern Ireland can work, and also convincing the large number of 25% of people from a Catholic background who tell our surveys that they would vote for the union if there was a referendum in the morning. The longer the politics of Northern Ireland is dysfunctional, the more downward pressure I think you will see on that particular number.
Yeah, there's sort of paradox upon paradox with this, Freya, it strikes me. One is, as Pat says, and Lisa as well, there is this rise of people for whom the constitutional question is not the be-all and end-all of their lives, and they're interested in other things as well. At the same time, certainly in the South and probably in the North, the constitutional question is higher up the political agenda, in large part because of the rise of Sinn Féin, particularly in the South recently. So we do know that if we do end up with a government led by Sinn Féin after the next general election in the South, you'll probably have a minister for reunification or something like that. You'll have all kinds of citizens' assemblies. You'll have a drive on the international front to promote the idea of Irish unity, and probably a rake of other things too. And I just wonder how all that's going to fit together for the people who are in Northern Ireland.
What yeah.
They think of that.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's really complex. And I mean, it's not the first thing in Northern Ireland politics that has been complex. This is a complex place. You know, look at our history, look at the way that it's governed. But I think this is sort of edging towards, and it's a thing that Alex and I have talked about before, and it's a thing that I've written about on many occasions. But it's that sort of touching on what Pat has said. You know, it always strikes me that if you are a unionist and that what you want most of all is to preserve the union, then you do need to make Northern Ireland work, which seems to be everybody's slogan. But you need it to work for the people who are unionists, but also for the people who are nothing, who are neither, who maybe would actually quite, you know, agree with the aspiration of United Ireland in the long term. But really, I'm actually quite happy now because I've got a good job and, you know, my kids are good school.
I might just look at the facts and say it's not worth it. Right now, where I haven't.
You need
to
make it, you know, a broad, attractive proposition for everybody. And in the last, you know, I mean, when did the Brexit start? You know, 10 years ago?
About 100 years.
It feels like 100 years. But, you know, actually what we've had has been, and I mean, that process started in Northern Ireland before that, but what we've had for the last 10 years roughly has been kind of a moving away from that position. And, you know, if you were Sinn Féin over the last couple of years when there was no government, in a sense, all you had to do was sit back, because the argument for United Ireland was being made for you. Because the more Northern Ireland appears not to work, and I mean, nobody can argue that, you know, not having a government is working, then the more people inevitably start to look at alternatives. And we saw that, you know, things like the Taoiseach talking about Plan B, things like, you know, talk about, you know, the role of the Irish government, joint authority, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, we saw that, because once you have a vacuum in government, there are other alternatives. And one of those alternatives is United Ireland or joint authority or whatever it's called. But that the fact that that comes on a background of Brexit, you know, which suddenly brought that whole question of borders, of, you know, what are we a member of, what are we not of, you know, it brought all those questions back to the forefront. And then the fact that we had no assembly for so long, you know, and it is, like it or not, we are now in this position where the constitutional question, the question about a United Ireland, border poll, whatever you want to term it, is going to be the question of the next political generation. And I don't know, I've forgotten what your question was, but this is the reality of where we are now. And I suppose just to kind of wind this up, you know, in that it is the people in the middle. I mean, if we talk about these non-aligned parties, there's just under, they're roughly a fifth. There was, I think, about 17-18% of the vote went to them in the last assembly election. So that's a fifth. Those are the people in a border poll scenario. They're the people who are going to decide one way or the other. It's not going to be your Sinn Féin voter. It's not going to be your TUV voter, UDV. It's those people in the middle.
And our research shows that the people who are least likely to persuade them are Sinn Féin. That's another part of it as well. And the other part of this, Alex, of course, is...
They're also not thrilled by the prospect of a Sinn Féin government in the Senate.
No, they're not. And another thing, which came up last week, Alex, which is this is a very expensive place. I'm not sure if people south of the border quite realise that professors Morgan Ross and Fitzgerald last week issued a report that it could cost 20 billion euro a year for the Republic to take on responsibility for all 32 counties. I mean, I was a bit taken aback by all these comparisons with East Germany. I mean, I don't pack my suitcase full of new Levi's when I come up here, you know. I don't point and laugh at the tiny little cars that people are driving, you know. I mean, I'm not actually sure that the disjunction is as huge as they suggest. But the thing that struck me about that report, and there was a lot of kerfuffle about it, mostly in the south, was, what do people think about that in the north? If anything, it's going to increase the maybe not unease about whether they'll, you know, what the consequences might be of a 32-county state, wouldn't they? Yes. I mean, are those feckers down in Dublin going to pay for us, basically?
Can I totally ignore that question for 1 minute? I will come back, but I just want to touch on this thing about the neithers and neithers and so on, and this 18 to 20%. The fact remains that 26 years after the Good Friday Agreement, in that first election, it was just under 90% of people voted for parties with a very clear, specific position on the constitutional status of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
At the last election, that was 80% still voting. So all this, at some point, as the border poll moves up the agenda, as the whole argument about all those people in the middle now, you can sit in the middle, you can be comfortable in the middle until the choice comes. Until that moment comes when somebody says, you know, your agnosticism, your atheism, your ambiguity, whatever it is, you're going to have to actually come down on one side or the other. So there is this thing about this middle ground which will shape the vote. But I think we're in danger of overestimating the actual power they will have on the day, because at this moment...
But do they not turn out to be decisive, though?
I'm not sure that...
They can't vote neither. During, I guess they could stay at home in the case of a border poll, but if they are to vote, that's why they will be decisive, because they're that chunk.
Well, there's a great line, I think it's Mark Twain said, the thing about agnostics, you know, when the crunch moment comes, they're never there. And I think I think we just need to bear that in mind. In terms of the report, and again, in moments like this, when you're asking people to change, because for unionists in particular, because you have a border poll and it goes against them, Northern Ireland disappears, their status, their citizenship, all of that disappears. Those are enormously difficult things. But I'm not convinced, I really am not convinced that the people are going to sit down You know, if you said to most unionists, for example, the price of staying in the United Kingdom is going to be an extra, you know, going to have to pay water charges, you're going to have to pay higher taxes, the vast majority of unions, I suspect, would go, fuck it, then we will then. You know, the same, I think, applies to Irish nationalism.
Sure.
If you said to them, there's a huge bill coming. And also, as the debate continues, you know, the both governments will begin to quietly roll this back. They'll say, yes, it might be 40 billion here and there, but it's not going to be taxpayers. They're not going to suddenly hit you with this massive bill. When the post-border poll negotiations, if assuming that is the United Ireland's decision, who knows? I would be shocked if the United Kingdom didn't choose to say, look, we'll bail you out, we'll help you along the way here. And they might give 20, 30, 40 years, because they're still going to have to pay the 10 billion, you know, if Northern Ireland still, they're still going to have to pay all those other things. So it's a case of whether the money is going into Northern Ireland, the United Kingdom, or Northern Ireland, which has been subsumed into a United Ireland. So I still think that when it comes to the, for most people who have political beliefs, political ideologies, who vote because they want somehow what their beliefs, they want the party or the country or the whatever it is that most recognises and accommodates their identity and so on, you know, that's emotional. That is, you know...
Well, the War of Independence didn't happen because Irish people thought they would definitely be richer when they became independent. Brexit didn't happen. I had a guest on the podcast only a few weeks ago who was taken to task over Brexit, and he said, I didn't vote yes for Brexit, which he did, in order to be richer. I didn't necessarily think we'd be richer. I thought we needed to take back control.
The general point I'm making is simply that I think we, a bit like the neithers and neithers, whatever, I think when it comes to the money in this, I think when you're asking people, make a decision, do you want to be citizens of the United Kingdom or citizens of the United Ireland, I don't think there'll be many people sitting there, oh, blah. I think they'll be going, no, my heart, my head, my history is somewhere
else. Can I just follow up
with
one further question on that, which is this, I accept that, but the fact is that Northern Ireland was created on the basis of being a majoritarian state. And whatever about the neithers and neithers, there is no majority anymore. Nobody has a majority anymore. Does that not profoundly, fundamentally change the politics of the place?
No, because I don't think it was. The odd thing is, unionism didn't say it was built on a majoritarian state. Whatever you think now, and I know that sounds a peculiar thing to say, because part of the psyche and psychology of unionism is they believe they were betrayed in 1921. They believe, it's the thing about unionism, we constantly believe that we are about to be betrayed. Put three unionists in a room and two of them will be working out who the other, you know, is the other one. It's just, we assume you, when people talk about, you know, the whether it's the Brexit thing or the status of Northern Ireland or the coming down of Stormont, you know, they try and blame Sinn Féin, they try and blame National, they try to blame Leo Varadkar and people like that. The damage done to unionism was done by the sovereign parliament of the United Kingdom, and that at the heart of, maybe that sums up everything about unionism, they don't know who to trust. And the very fact that they sold the return to Stormont on the basis that it's better to have an imperfect devolution than an imperfect direct rule from London. And I think for when unionists begin to talk about how many candidates they're going to field and what the future is and how they work in Northern Ireland, they have to start actually facing up to the reality that their friends are probably not in London. They may be a lot closer.
And never were, Lisa. Were their friends ever in London?
That's a very good question. We could talk all night about that. I was going to say, we do polling, have been doing polling since throughout the negotiations and the protocol and all of that drama. And the one of the most consistent and standout findings has been when we've asked people in Northern Ireland across the board, who do you trust to act for Northern Ireland's interests in the context of working out its post-Brexit arrangements? The highest that the UK government got was 8%.
Wow.
That high, yeah. Well, it went down to within the margin of error, so it technically could have been no one, but that's across the board. That's everybody distrusting the UK government. And I think that is a very important aspect and dynamic, indirect as it may be, in explaining where we're at in our politics now. The new salience of constitutional change as a possibility, as well as Sinn Féin's position in the South, and also all of what has gone before in terms of the spinning of unionist identity here and sense of a confusion of vision, because if you're a unionist, you're united to something, but what's on the other side? And I think that's a very real question in part. I was going to make one also just techie point around neithers and neithers and the UK government position. if we're talking about the possibility of a border poll coming to the fore, that rests on the discernment of the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, UK government minister, deeming it likely that the majority of the people in Northern Ireland would vote in favour for Irish unity. If those who are undecided, and that group that is undecided, gets increasingly significant in our electoral landscape, it's going to get much harder to determine conclusively the outcome of any given vote, which does give a perpetual opt-out for a Secretary of State for Northern Ireland that doesn't want to hold a border poll.
Well, it's always been a rather deliberately vague measure, hasn't it? The wording of that, what does it actually mean, Pat?
Constructive ambiguity is part of that furniture.
The wording of the text is when it appears likely to him that it will.
I'll try selling that to you this year. You're going to lose. We're going to have the border poll anyway. That's the difficulty too.
You could certainly do. I mean, I think predictions of a border poll by the end of the decade are fanciful, but I do think that before the end of the decade, a British government will have to say what it means by that. Is it? I mean, it isn't too hard to imagine, right? I mean, it could be, results, election results, constant polling, breakdown in the assembly. It's got to be some combination of those, right? But I would imagine that if not the next British government, then, maybe one in the not too distant future will have to say what they mean by that, particularly if you get a Sinn Féin-led government in Dublin.
So they need to define it in advance before that moment arrives. Mm-hmm. They need to say clearly X, because really it's just on polls, isn't it? I mean, certain amount of...
They're reluctant, though,
to define that.
Yes,
they define what it is. It's out of their hands. If that criteria then is met, then it's really difficult for them.
A single 51% poll. I mean, just an irrational, a reasonable person would not describe that as meeting the deficit.
No, it would have to be presumably over over a number of years. But I think that is one of the stages that this will have to move on to. Can I say one thing about the financial questions? And I accept absolutely that for an awful lot of people, questions of sovereignty and national allegiance will trump questions of economics. But there's two votes. There's one in the north and there's one in the south. And both have to be passed.
I love the idea of the north voting yes and the south voting no. That is really excellent.
That would keep me in columns for months. I'd love that.
We do know from the polling evidence that when you put it to people in the south that it would cost them money, that they suddenly, many of them, suddenly start to have second thoughts. And I think it doesn't take a huge amount of foresight to understand that questions of economics will have a very important part, will have a very important role in the debate in the South. And I think that is part of the picture, the current picture in the South, which we know a good bit more about now after the research that we've done on the subject for the last 2 years. And what the summary of that, without going into any great detail on it, the summary of that basically is that the South is in favour of unity, but that support is overwhelmingly in favour of unity. Two-thirds say they would vote for it in the morning. But that support, while it is a mile wide, parts of it are an inch deep.
It's extremely when you start to ask them
not just about the economics, but about things like flags and symbols and whether, say, for instance, Northern Ireland would continue as a devolved entity within a new United Ireland, when you begin to ask them about guaranteed representation for unionists in an all-Ireland cabinet, when you begin to ask them about things like as innocuous as the Commonwealth, then suddenly there's a massive pushback. So it seems to me that, the debate in the South is at a very, very early stage. And I think, for the health of politics on the island, it seems to me that for the advocates of Irish unity, there are two questions. There's one, can you get support for a united Ireland, North and South? But more importantly, there's also then, can you make a success of it? Mm. And there has been very little self-examination in the South, I think, about how you might do
that. What do you think about that, Freya, as somebody who works for a 32-county newspaper, albeit one with its headquarters in Dublin? That, you know, there's a lot of hot air spoken about unity south of the border. I think people think about it more and understand some of the consequences the closer you get to the border. But there is incredible shallowness otherwise about the subject.
Yeah, and I mean, some of that is just geography. I mean, it's back to the comment, and it's back to what Pat was saying about, you know, well, when you're in Clonmel, you know, Limerick is, you know, seems a long way away.
And Tipperary,
know,
people are the Tipperary way.
Tipperary people
already. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been to Cork precisely once in my life for an afternoon.
It's,
you know,
for
I
anyone.
Mean, you know, so I mean, I'm in no position to kind of lecture, and it's just because, you know, it's really far away. It's the other end of the country. Well, let's not, you know, apologies to the people of Cork. So you know, part of it is just that, and I think this is historic. I mean, some of it is, it comes from the Troubles. I mean, we all know people, and we've heard stories about people who wouldn't come up to the north during the Troubles, or vice versa, because it was seen as too dangerous, or sure, they're all mad up there, you know, what would you want anything to do with that? So some of that does endure. I think in terms of the attitudes to all of this and how it would change, I think. And I know Pat's polling kind of, well, goes against this, maybe goes against isn't the right word, but I do think that in terms of the referendum in the South, I think it will be about identity. And, you know, you can ask people all day long about the economics and the health services and things like this, but I think when you put somebody who considers himself an Irish man or an Irish woman, particularly somebody from south of the border, in a polling booth, and you ask them, do you want a united Ireland, yes or no? I think most of them will vote yes, because I think at that point it comes down to emotion and it comes down to identity. I mean, interestingly, and from the looking at things sort of from the northern side of things, I've spent a lot of time over the years I've been working for the Irish Times talking to people about these questions, and it's really interesting, you know, when you go into nationalist areas and you ask them about, you know, oh yeah, absolute fear of United Ireland. And then you say to them, well, what about the health service? What about the NHS? Oh, well, no, you know, well, we would need to have that. And when you start to, even though, I mean, the problems with the NHS and the health service here are a whole other podcast, but when you start to unpick it economically, I think it's just so much more complex. And there's sort of two particular points I'm going to finish with on this. One is, again, looking back to that survey, and it all focused sort of on the subvention that Northern Ireland gets from the UK to keep it going, but it didn't really look at some of the benefits, and, you know, or the potential benefits. What happens if you put two economies together? And I'm from a border area, I'm from Derry, so I know very well that the impact of the border in that area, you know, Derry was cut off from its hinterland in Donegal. So rather than being, you know, a big city sort of in the middle of things, it's right on the edge of Northern Ireland. And when you go to Letterkenny, and this has been the case for 10, 15, 20 years, when you go to Letterkenny, which is a much smaller town 20 miles away, Letterkenny is booming, and it is big foreign companies. There are jobs. I mean, every time you go there, it has just grown because they're building things.
You've whereas grown Derry has none of that.
In an incredibly, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I've never seen as many roundabouts in my life, you know. But nevertheless, you know, it is growing in the way that Derry, I mean, I haven't looked at the latest figures, but Derry and Strabane has always been an unemployment black spot in Northern Ireland, always. You know, it always is. You know, house prices are some of the lowest in the UK. It has always been the economic black spot. So that, I think, would be one of the areas where we would see growth. And the other point that I was going to make about this, and this is touching on what Pat said about when you start looking at things like flags and anthem, and that support, it's not even the support, it's the understanding in the South that even maybe we should just look at this, you know, that if this is about making, rather than having a united Ireland, which sounds like we're going to take two bits and stick them together, and it's basically going to be the South, but sort of bigger.
The Germany model.
Hugh says it so much better. That's why he's in charge. But actually, if it's about creating something new, well, actually, it's eminently reasonable. Well, why wouldn't you look at a flag or an anthem, particularly if the ultimate goal is we want a new country where everybody can feel valued and included. And again, when you take that research and you go, I mean, I've taken that to unionist community groups. I've spoken to people who were members of the RUC, members of the security forces, and talked to them about that. And they're really surprised and they're really shocked. And they say, well, why actually can't you just say, well, actually, maybe the flag is... Let's just have a conversation about it. Let's why not talk about the anthem? You know, all the giving is meant to be on our side, you know. And when you put it kind of in that sense of fairness, it's like, well, yeah, actually, why shouldn't all this stuff be on the table and we should talk about it? There's, I mean, this is probably decades of work to look at all this, but I think it just touches on that point about the level of preparedness. And I think in the South in particular, you know, it needs to go beyond just, oh, well, we just sort of join everything up and it's okay. There is a debate that needs to happen and it needs to look at that kind of thing in depth and think then about how, it's about how you make something new potentially rather than just expect unionism. I don't know why I'm pointing at Alex here, but rather than just expecting that to be grafted on. So, there's so much in this, I think, that needs to be unpicked that hasn't been.
I'll do a kind of rapid fire round. Unionist didn't like our last Taoiseach very much, Alex. Does getting a new one improve, have a prospect of improving relations in any way?
Well, I may be a lone voice in unionism. I had a soft spot for him. I think unionists... do you know, I think deep down, unionists would have been very happy if their own prime minister had stood up for their interests in exactly the same way Leo Varadkar was standing up for what were Irish interests. In terms of Simon Harris, I think we've already heard all the leaders of unionism say, well, let's give him a chance, let's reset the gauge, let's, you know, work towards some new relationship. I would give that 3 months before one of them says he's another bloody traitor or something like that. it's just the nature of things, because there's no Taoiseach other than saying the words, we don't want Northern Ireland, we don't want to upset you, we don't want to have negotiations with anyone. Sinn Féin and the SDLP, we couldn't care less about. Yes, unionism will love them at that point, but the minute they do,
they probably still give to do.
Hmm?
They probably still give up.
Is it not the case, sorry to jump in, taking your job here, is it not the case so that the leaders of unionism had a much better relationship, including Geoffrey Donaldson, with Micheál Martin when he was Taoiseach?
They did, because partly because Micheál Martin is very easy to talk to. He is, you know, it's sometimes an attribute which is not fully understood by people outside the political bubble. But affability is a very powerful weapon. And he was always affable. And you always got the sense, whether he was or wasn't listening, you always got the sense that he was actually listening to you. And the trouble with Simon Coveney, because the unionists didn't like him either, because he was another one of these people that actually told them what he thought. And we don't always want to be told that either. It's important, though, you know, just the simple facts of life together, you know.
Well, Harris is quite affable, you know.
I haven't met him yet, so I'm not going to prejudge him. I'll wait till I've seen him and then I'll post-judge him, if there's such a thing.
Lisa, I have a question, and I was thinking of the first one. It's too big a question for a rapid fire, so I'll try and drill it down a little bit. I mean, you've written about the constitutional position, going back to the Act of Union, through the Government of Ireland Act, forward to the Belfast Agreement. There was a lot of talk around the Northern Ireland Protocol that Northern Ireland is going to have the best of both worlds, and perhaps some of the benefits which Freya was referring to there would actually accrue to Northern Ireland being both part of the EU and part of the UK. Is there any serious talk about that happening in any way on the ground?
In order to have the best of both worlds and to allow economic benefit to accrue to Northern Ireland, because it has now shifted into this pivotal position, which I do think is it's sort of like a shadow issue in the whole constitutional future question, because we are now the touching point between the UK market and the EU market. And that centre of Venn diagram, that could be really beneficial because we have access to the UK that isn't the case anywhere else on the island of Ireland, and we have access to the EU market that isn't the case anywhere else within the state that we're currently in. But in order for that to work, you need stability, you need good management because it's complex, and also you need a well-developed and open sort of policy-oriented conversation. And the culture here has typically emphasised politics more than policy. And so we could be in the process of shifting, kind of a forced shift, to start to look at more policy issues like trade, supply chains and standards of goods, and what we want in terms of the way we address climate issues on the island of Ireland, how we do cross-border travel, all of that stuff that that touches on this new sort of position as a point of being the pivot between those two markets.
Mm.
But it has to work.
Yeah. And can it work?
I think it can, but the ask is big. And the key is stability, which we haven't been good at.
Mm. Pat, your rapid fire question is pertains to the, I was going to say the new government, but it's not really a new government, is it? I had a listener on to me, we described it as a, in our podcast, which we put up yesterday, as a reshuffle. And this listener said, it wasn't a reshuffle. Two people stepped down from their jobs and they were replaced. That's not a reshuffle. And they had a point, I think. It's fairly minimalist stuff. It seems to me that from the perspective of our subject here this evening, the government parties and the opposition parties are now laser focused on the secondary election, which is happening in June, the Europeans and the locals, into the budget and onto the general. It's 10 months of electioneering, and they just want Northern Ireland to stay quiet for the moment, don't they?
Yeah, and it's the case that Northern Ireland tends not to matter in domestic politics. Now, maybe that changes a little bit with the increased prominence of Sinn Féin, but I suspect not all that much. For all the time and effort that southern politicians, and particularly people like Bertie Ahern, I would guess it was thrust on Varadkar. Micheál Martin has devoted a fair bit of time for it, both as Taoiseach and as Minister for Foreign Affairs, and he's obviously set up the Shared Island initiative. But northern politics tends not to matter in southern elections. I think there was maybe a residual benefit for Fianna Fáil under Bertie Ahern. There was a bit of a glow amongst voters
in 2002
after the Good Friday Agreement that spilled into 2002, but it didn't last much beyond that. So
there you go. You don't matter.
So yeah, I mean, I don't see it playing. I don't see it playing a role. I don't see that what happens in the north playing a significant role in the immediate future.
Is there any politics beyond campaigning in the Republic over the next 10 months? Is it just all about the campaign? And
I mean, everything is, like, there is politics beyond that. I mean, there's stuff that's happening in Europe, but everything is refracted through the electoral lens. I mean, the entire rationale, one of the biggest things that can happen, I know you don't think it was much of a reshuffle, but one of the biggest things that can happen in domestic politics is the Taoiseach changes. And that was driven by the proximity of the election. It was the old guy saying, I'm going to get creamed in the election. I don't have the fire in my belly for it. I'm going to pass it on to a guy who clearly has, if anything, a surfeit of fire in his belly for it. So everything that is done. And that's why I think you'll see Simon Harrison. He's talked about this both publicly and, as I understand it, privately, getting his ministers to zero in on a couple of things that can play well politically before the next election and allow him to go to the next election and give a version, point to a couple of things that that his ministers have done in the immediate past, and give a version of the only slogan that any incumbent government running for election can do, a version of a lot done, more to do.
Well, not that again.
I'm afraid so. Well, that's what every incumbent government has to say.
And that's it for today's show. Thanks very much to Alice, to Lisa Clare, to Freya, to Pat, and to our producer Declan Conlon, and our engineer JJ Vernon. We hope you enjoyed this live show. We're going to do a few more later in the year, so look out for those. But I'll be back with another show next week. Until then, thanks very much for listening.